city of Khan Yunis, which came under intense bombardment. The vicinity of Nasser Hospital was among the areas targeted in Khan Yunis. The regime also fired artillery at surrounding areas of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in the northern Gaza Strip. The fresh attacks have killed over 100 people. The head of the Red Cross says Israel's resumed onslaught has brought back a nightmare situation for the Palestinian territory. Meanwhile, sirens have also sounded in Israeli settlements near Gaza amid rocket and missile attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel and the United States are responsible for the expiration of a ceasefire in Gaza.
We blame the failure on two sides, the Israeli and American sides. It was clear yesterday that the Israeli side wants to go back to fighting, as several ideas were put forward by mediators, and we accepted three of them. And despite that, the Israeli side said no, no, no every time.
Hamdan said the U.S. has given a green light to Israel for the resumption of its atrocities in Gaza. However, he said Hamas is ready to respond to any serious mediatory effort to cease Israeli aggression. The spokesman also reiterated that Israel's military captives in Gaza will only be handed over if all Palestinian prisoners are released from Israeli jails. There are more than 8,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Nearly 3,000 were arrested after the regime's onslaught on Gaza. Mona Kandil is joining us now from Ramallah to bring us up to speed on the situation right now, as the Israelis have yet again continued their massacre and onslaught against the Palestinians in Gaza. And also, as we've seen over the past weeks, there have been demonstrations in support of the Palestinians in Gaza in various cities across the occupied West Bank as well. Mona, what's going on your end of things?
Unfortunately, immediately after the truce expired, the Israeli military didn't wait a moment. They started to bombard and shell, carry out airstrikes against several areas in the occupied, in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli military carried out airstrikes on residential areas, residential apartments, and attacking civilians. And killing, according to Palestinian Ministry of Health, 109 Palestinians since the end of the truce and since the early hours of Friday. Unfortunately, in all over the Gaza Strip had been hit, in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, Jabalia, and in Beit Hanun. Several areas were hit. In addition to the aggression of the Israeli military, the Israelis had, spread leaflets. People there in the southern Gaza Strip found leaflets from the Israeli military. These leaflets reading that the Palestinians in Deir el-Balah and in Khan Yunis must leave these areas and head to Rafah, near the borders with Egypt. This means that even the southern Gaza Strip now would be attacked by the Israeli military. First of all, the Israelis claim that Hamas headquarters and Hamas fighters were hiding in several areas in northern the Gaza Strip, and they ordered the people to leave northern the Gaza Strip from Jabalia, Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, and center the Gaza Strip to the southern of the Gaza Strip. Despite the bombardment, despite the daily killing, however, tens of thousands of people remained in their homes because there's no other place to go. Even if they moved to the southern areas has been hit all the time. People on their way to the Gaza, to the southern Gaza Strip has been also attacked by the Israeli military. And the Israelis had even arrested a number of people on their way from northern the Gaza Strip and center the Gaza Strip to the south area. People, many, had been detained, including women, at least 10 Palestinian female Gazans. According to those Palestinian prisoners who had been recently released from the Israeli jails, we are speaking about the female Palestinian prisoners who were freed due to the swap deal with Hamas movement. They said that they saw 10 Palestinian women had been detained from the Gaza Strip and that they had been tortured However, they do not their identity because the Israeli soldiers have taken them into solitary confinement, and they were not they had not been allowed to stay with the other Palestinian prisoners from the occupied West Bank. Protests and demonstrations have been taking place, as you have said. But at the same time, people here are demanding, even those are taking part in the protests, they are demanding that there must be more action. People should not only take part in protests and demonstrations in the centers of the city. They are doing their utmost to gather more and more people to head to the areas where Israeli military checkpoints are located and the Israeli settlements. But there is one thing, and at the end of the day, the Israeli forces have closed several areas across the occupied West Bank. More military checkpoints had been held. Dozens of Israeli soldiers had been sent to each area in Ramallah, in Nablus, Jenin, Tul Kerem, in Al Khalil. The areas that the road that had taken in the past 2 hours, let's say, from Ramallah to Jenin, today it takes 5 hours. And at the same time, you will be passing several military checkpoints, and the soldiers are the ones who decide whether to allow in these areas or not, especially that people with their IDs saying that they are originally from other areas, not Jenin and Tul Kerem and Qalqilia. So Palestinians today are hoping that the international community, the world countries would be able to pressurize the American administration to force Israel in its war. Today, not a ceasefire is needed. Today, Palestinians say end of the war and the genocide must be seen in the Gaza Strip, because the Israelis and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu knows very well, if he today ends the war on the Gaza Strip, he will lose everything, as the experts are saying. He will not be the Prime Minister anymore. And he's facing several charges inside the Israeli regime and the cabinet. So that's why he continues to find more and more excuses to last this war on the Gaza Strip and to continue the ground operation there. Palestinians today are demanding that the world must interfere and force the American administration first to force Israel to stop its genocide on Gaza.
Mona, one more issue I'd like you to address before we leave you. The reports stating, according to the Ezzedine Al-Ghassan Brigades, that the cities of Ashkelon, Beersheba, Sderot, they've been targeted by a barrage of rockets in occupied Palestine. So that basically highlights the failure once again of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, which was intended to weaken and eradicate the military capabilities of the resistance forces in Gaza. So talk to us about that as well.
That's right. The Al-Qassam Brigades issued a statement saying that its fighters succeeded to fire a number of rockets into the occupied lands, into Israel, and they are sure that a number of Israeli soldiers had been wounded. Later, the Israeli military revealed that at least 5 Israeli soldiers had been hit as one of the Palestinian the Palestinian resistance groups' rockets had launched into a military base around the Gaza Strip. And here in the occupied territories, 2 days ago, Palestinian brothers carried out an anti-Israeli operation at one of the military checkpoints in Al-Quds, near the at the entrance to an illegal settlement. And the Hamas movement claimed responsibility, saying that those 2 martyrs who had been, of course, the brothers, they were members of the Hamas movement. And the Israelis also said that the 2 brothers who had been martyred and carried out the shooting that led to the killing of 4 Israelis and at least 8 others had been wounded. they said that they were Hamas members. So it's very clear. The issue is while the Israelis are doing their utmost to fight the Palestinian resistance and Hamas members in the Gaza Strip, and at the same time, the resistance is still strong. They are still able to have their rockets and to fire their rockets, causing, even if it's not severe damage, but they are causing losses to the Israeli military and the Israeli settlers. And at the same time, even if every several days or more than that, we are seeing the shooting here and there. However, the members of Hamas movement and other resistance groups are still fighting the Israeli forces across the occupied territories.
Thanks, Slide. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. The resumption of Israel's brutal aggression on Gaza has drawn widespread condemnations, with the United Nations Human Rights Chief describing it as catastrophic.
A statement from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights that I'll read out now. The resumption of hostilities in Gaza is catastrophic. We urge all parties and states with influence over them to redouble efforts immediately to ensure a ceasefire on humanitarian and human rights grounds.
Well, the spokesperson stressed that as an occupying power, Israel is required under international humanitarian law to ensure Palestinians' access to basic needs such as food and water. UN Chief Antonio Guterres also regretted the resumption of strikes and hoped a ceasefire agreement could be reached. The head of the Red Cross said the renewed attacks bring Gazans back to what he described as a nightmarish situation before the pause. Robert Mardini warned that Gaza is in a very precarious state and civilians have nowhere safe to go. UNICEF also appealed for a lasting ceasefire and said inaction on Gaza is an approval of the killing of children. The UN agency stressed that more attacks will lead to nothing other than carnage. Thousands of Iranians across the country have hit the streets to denounce the Israeli regime's atrocities in the Palestinian territories. They called for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Demonstrators carried Palestinian flags and held banners that read "Down with Israel" and "Free Palestine." Iranians also slammed the United States and Britain's complicity in the brutal Israeli war. Thousands also flooded the streets of the Yemeni cities of Sana'a and Sa'ada, calling for an end to the bloodshed in the besieged territory. The rallies come after the Gaza-based resistance movement Hamas called for demonstrations worldwide on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in solidarity with Palestinians. Numerous demonstrations have already taken place in different parts of the world since the war on Gaza broke out nearly 2 months ago. Youssef Maori is joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, to bring us up to speed on the widespread demonstrations that were ongoing today in Yemen, specifically the ones that took place in Sana'a and the northern city of Sa'ada. Youssef?
So the demonstration that just concluded about an hour ago here in the capital, Sana'a, was primarily aimed at supporting the strategic military measures aimed at supporting the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. This was actually the title of today's demonstration in the capital, Sana'a, which occurred just an hour after Friday prayers. The measures that the protesters today are supporting are measures that they are calling for the undertaken by the Yemeni government and by the Yemeni army. One of these measures is the continuation of launching aerial attacks against the Israeli entity, launching drones and launching Yemeni ballistic missiles into occupied Palestinian territory. Other measures include the continuation of capturing and blacklisting any ships in the Red Sea that are linked to the Israeli entity. And we've seen the Yemeni naval forces capture two Israeli-linked ships over the past couple of weeks, and we can expect this to continue. Other measures include the, adopting new measures to the military initiative by Yemeni army, and such measures include also targeting and blacklisting nations that are supporting the Israeli genocide on Palestinians. And this includes Arab nations in the Middle East, and this also includes Western powers like the U.S. and European nations. So their ships and their cargo shipments in the Red Sea, which pass through Bab el-Mandab on a daily basis, they could be blacklisted and ultimately prevented from crossing over from the Red Sea to the Arabian Sea through Bab el-Mandab. And as I mentioned, the Yemeni army is looking to adopt more measures in the coming future, in the near future, if this genocide continues against the Palestinians. Of course, we see that the Israeli regime has resumed its military offensive in the besieged Gaza, and this is something that's going to only add more and more condemnation, not just against the Israeli regime, but also against other Arab nations like Saudi Arabia, the Jordanian government, Egypt, and also the UAE, from not just the Yemeni people, but from the masses of the Muslim world who are starting to connect the dots and who are starting to see that Saudi Arabia, along with the UAE, you know, and the Jordanian government, as well as the Egyptian government, by them not preventing the genocide from happening, and this is something, you know, this is, they have the military capability to step in and to help the Palestinians. If they're not going to do that, then they are going to be considered part of the Israeli coalition against Palestinians, and the axis of resistance, as far as Ansarullah is concerned, they're going to also face, being blacklisted and being prevented from crossing over through Bab el-Mandeb in the Red Sea. And this includes the Egyptian government, this includes the Jordanian government, and the Saudi-led coalition, the nations who waged a war on Yemen for 8 years and imposed a strangling blockade on Yemen. And this despite threats from the U.S., the Yemeni support will continue, according to the demonstration today, despite the threats from the United Nations and from the United States primarily, that they will impose another strangling blockade on Yemen, and Yemen could be susceptible to another war being launched by Israel and the U.S. government.
Thanks a lot, Youssef Maori, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations top climate official Simon Steele has warned that world leaders have to stop doodling and start doing when it comes to carbon emission cuts. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website yahoo.com has covered this story and tells us more. Global climate investment needs to rise to $3.6 trillion by 2026, Alliance Trade has said ahead of the COP28 Environmental Summit this week. The fortnight-long conference will begin on Thursday, 30th of November in Dubai, hosted by the United Arab Emirates, with scores of world leaders and delegates from almost 200 nations set to attend the summit. It's said to be the biggest annual climate congress held under the 1995 United Nations Convention on Climate Change, with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak set to arrive in the Middle East on Friday, 1st of December. However, there are warnings that the world has made alarming slow progress to achieve the Paris Climate Accord, a legally binding treaty aiming to keep temperature rises well below 2 degrees Celsius. Credit insurer Alliance Trade says investment worldwide needs to hit $3.6 trillion in just 2 years and reach $4.4 trillion by 2046, as they called the next 10 years the decisive decade. Analysts are saying this implies a staggering investment need of approximately $5,000 per ton of annual carbon dioxide emissions, without applying any discount and disregarding impacts on operational costs, while assuming a social cost of carbon at $200 per ton of carbon dioxide. This level of investment would become financially viable after 25 years. It comes after the United Nations top climate official Simon Steele warned that world leaders have to stop doodling and start doing when it comes to carbon emission cuts. Simon Steele told The Guardian, "We're now at a point where we are all on the front line, yet most governments are still strolling when they need to be sprinting." The COP28 will focus on energy transition, climate finance, adaptation and resilience, and inclusivity, with a goal of tripling global renewable energy capacity by 2030. Decarbonisation, capture and storage, and cutting methane emissions are crucial targets, while getting the Loss and Damage Fund, established at COP27 summit with the promise of wealthy nations providing $100 billion a year to poorer countries, is a key climate finance priority. The COP28 summit marks the conclusion of the first global stocktake, which evaluated progress on the 2015 Paris Climate Change Agreement. But net zero emissions is no longer even a viable goal, Alliance analysis found, with the window of opportunity to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius target via mitigation having already closed. A briefing by Ludovic Subran, chief economist, stated, "The global economy has made alarmingly slow progress towards achieving the promises of the Paris Climate Accord. The global economy would need to cut carbon emissions nearly by minus 13% every year from 2025 to 2033. The coronavirus pandemic in 2020 only managed to reduce carbon emissions by minus 7%. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. World leaders must stop doodling and start doing on carbon emission cuts, as rapidly rising temperatures this year have put everyone on the front line of disaster, the United Nations top climate official Simon Steele has warned. Simon Steele added, "No country could think of itself as immune from catastrophe." Steele will oversee the crucial COP28 climate summit that begins next week in Dubai. Scores of world leaders will arrive in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, for 10 talks on how to tackle the crisis. "We're used to talking about protecting people on the far-flung front lines. We're now at the point where we're all on the front line." Simon Steele added, "We're used to talking about protecting people on the far-flung front lines, but we're now at the point where all of us are on the front line." He added, "Yet most governments are still strolling when they need to be sprinting. Global temperatures have broken new records in recent months, making this year the hottest year on record and perilously close to the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels that countries have agreed to hold on to. Temperatures are now heading for a hellish 3 degrees Celsius increase unless urgent and drastic action is taken, but greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise." Simon Steele said it was still possible to cut greenhouse gas emissions enough to stay within the crucial limit, but that further delay would be dangerous. "Every year of the baby steps we've been taking up to this point means that we need to be taking much bigger leaps," with each following year if we are to stay in this race. The science is absolutely clear about this. The fortnight-long COP28 summit will start this Thursday, 30th of November in Dubai, hosted by the United Arab Emirates, a major oil and gas producing country. Scores of world leaders, senior ministers and officials from 198 countries will be in attendance, along with an estimated 70,000 delegates, making it the biggest annual conference of the COP summit held under the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is expected to attend the summit, and also the British monarch King Charles III will give the opening speech, along with the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and the President of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. The leader of the world's Catholics, the Pope, will also attend the summit, as well as the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen. Many world leaders from 198 countries will also attend the summit in Dubai. The presidents of the world's two biggest greenhouse gas emitters, Joe Biden of the United States and Xi Jinping of China, are not expected to attend the COP28 summit. But their envoys, John Kerry and Xi Jinhua, have signaled their close cooperation before the talks begin. Sultan Al Jaber, the chief of the United Arab Emirates national oil company ADNOC, will preside over the COP28 summit. Sultan Al Jaber has come under fierce criticism from green campaigners for his dual role, but Simon Steele claimed this was a distraction. Simon Steele said, "This is not the first COP summit to be hosted by a fossil fuel producing nation, and it certainly won't be the last. Every country, even those that are major oil producers, have their role to play," he said. "But what is important are the messages and the signals that the incoming president is giving, and they speak of the need for urgent action and a focus on the how. How do we speed up the transition to a new decarbonized world?" Fossil fuel executives are likely to be out in force at the summit, as they have been an increasing presence at COP summits in recent years. Simon Steele added, "It's important that we recognize that the fossil fuel industry has to be part of the solution. We know where the problem is, but in order to progress the conversation from what needs to be done to how it needs to be done, the fossil fuel industry has to be part of the conversation." However, Simon Steele insisted these companies had to show that they were serious about shifting the world to a zero-carbon economy. Steele said, "Their engagement in the process has to be legitimate, has to be speaking to the necessary actions that are taking the transition away from our current dependence on fossil fuels to a new decarbonized business model." One key issue at the COP28 summit will be the provision of finance for the rescue and rehabilitation of the poorest and most vulnerable communities in the world. The absence of this loss and damage funding has been a long-standing grievance for developing countries, but earlier this month, countries agreed to a blueprint for the fund. Rich countries have yet to pledge contributions to the fund, however. Simon Steele called on world leaders to come with pledges. He said, "A fund that is established without the resources capitalized won't get us to where we need to be. That opportunity for donors to send strong signals as to how the fund will be capitalized and the scale of that capitalization is on offer at the COP28 summit in Dubai."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
For tonight, I would like to actually talk about the importance of the house of Fatima, the term Bayt Fatima, followed by the question whether that Bayt of Fatima was attacked or not. I'll keep it brief, but I would like this to be kind of a final and decisive, you know, discussion about it. The term Bayt Fatima, the house of Fatima. Normally, in our Eastern culture, you relate the house to the men of the house. But we see, interestingly, when it comes to the incidents after the wafat of Rasulullah, Shia and Sunni both, when they talk about this incident, what happened, they always use the term Bayt Fatima. They don't say Bayt Ali. And I thought maybe it would be, you know, important to just to understand that concept, that there must be a basis for it. When we talk about the Bayt, the house of Ali and Fatima, you know, it's not just an ordinary house. When you talk about the Panjatan, Ayat Athir is there to talk about their purity, infallibility. But it's not only the persons who are known as Ahle Kisa or Panjatan, as we call them in Urdu of Farsi, that they are the one who are on that level of perfection. Even the places and things associated to them acquires a special blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even that house in which Ali and Fatima lived becomes a selected place, becomes a sacred place. And you might say, well, where he is getting all this from? Let me go to Surah Nur, Surah number 24 of the Quran, Ayat 36 to 38, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, talking about the impact of the divine light and nur of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, how it goes to different levels of the universe and how it impacts. Then he says, في بيوت أذن الله أن ترفع ويذكر فيها اسمه يسبح له فيها بالغدو والعصال. He says, in the houses. Now he's talking about special houses. He says, in the houses that Allah has permitted to be raised or elevated. You know, people have a problem with building shrines of the Anbiya or the Imam. This is the ayat. It's not talking about, you know, Turfa in a sense, zikr, because it comes, wa yuthkar, and therein his name is chanted. And he is glorified in them during the mornings and the mid-afternoons. Rijalun, he says, these are the houses in which you will find men whom neither business nor sale diverts from remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, from performing the prayers and giving the charity. Then he goes on. This is because they fear the day of judgment, you know, where everything will be, you know, clear in front of us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses the words in this ayat where he says, even the hearts and the minds of people will be transformed. Not in a physical sense, but the reality will be there. Nobody will be able to deny what is the truth. And then he talks about the reward. Now, what are these houses that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about? Fi buyutin adhina Allah an turfa'a wa yuthkar fiha ismu. The houses that Allah has allowed to be raised or elevated, and in which the name of Allah is chanted or recited. This is a question which was actually asked by one of the companions when the Prophet recited this ayah for the first time to them. And we should be thankful to those companions who asked these questions. More interestingly, the follow-up question which will come up. This is a narration not from a Shia tafsir. This is from Jalaluddin Suyuti. This is a hadith-based tafsir of the Sunnis. There, Jalaluddin Suyuti quotes in his Ad-Durrul Manthur two individuals, Anas bin Malik and Buraydah, that they, when the Prophet recited these three ayat about the buyut, about the houses, you know, a person stood up and he asked the Prophet, and he says, what are these houses that they have been mentioned in this ayat of Quran? And this is where the Prophet says, buyutul anbiya. This refers not to just ordinary house or a masjid. This refers to the houses of the prophets. When I say the follow-up question, then a very prominent Sahabi stood up. Suyuti names him. He says, then Abu Bakr stood up. As a follow-up question, I don't know why he asked this question. Probably he knew something that we don't know. Because he asked Rasulullah, Ya Rasulullah, هذا البيت منها لبيت علي وفاطمة. These houses that you are mentioning, which have been mentioned in this ayat of Quran, and you are saying this is referring to the buyut al-anbiya, is this house of Ali and Fatima included in that group or not? For him even to raise that question is very interesting. At least for that moment we'll say thank you. At least you raised this question and we got the answer from Rasulullah. Then Rasulullah responds by saying, Na'am, yes, the house of Ali and Fatima is included in that list. Not only that, min afadiliha, it is among the best of those houses. So the house of Fatima is not just a house. It is a house which is included in this ayat, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says he has allowed those houses to be elevated, raised. And in these houses, Allah's name is chanted and recited. And this is where we have to realize that, you know, when we see this term, Bayt Fatima, it has a meaning behind it. There is a sacredness and holiness attached to that place, which was the residence of Ali and Fatima, salawatullah alayhum. But let me come to the main question. What happened to Bayt Fatima? What happened to house of Fatima after Rasulullah? You know, Rasulullah identified that as one of the best and elevated houses in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The expectation was that Muslims in general will respect not only the people of the house, but the house itself. But the irony is that the same people who actually asked this question of Rasulullah, whether the house of Ali and Fatima is included in this list or not, they were the first one actually who oppressed the people of the house, and they burned down its door. And in that process, they basically hurt the daughter of the Prophet.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's King Charles III is benefiting from the deaths of citizens in northwest of England. According to a new report, the Duchy of Lancaster, managed by King Charles's hereditary estate, has collected tens of millions of pounds from financial assets known as bona vacantia, owned by people who died without a will or any known next of kin. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. King Charles III is profiting from the deaths of thousands of people in northwest of England, whose assets are secretly being used to upgrade a commercial property empire managed by King Charles's hereditary estate. The Duchy of Lancaster, a controversial land and property estate that generates huge profits for King Charles III, has collected tens of millions of pounds in recent years, under an antiquated system that dates back to feudal times. Financial assets known as bona vacantia, owned by people who have died without a will or any known next of kin, are collected by the Duchy of Lancaster. Over the last 10 years, it has collected more than £60 million in the funds. It has long claimed that after deducting costs, bona vacantia revenues are donated to charities. However, only a small percentage of these revenues is being given to charity. Internal duchy documents seen by The Guardian reveal how funds are secretly being used to finance the renovation of properties that are owned by King Charles III and rented out for profit. The Duchy of Lancaster essentially inherits bona vacantia funds from people whose last known address was in a territory that in the Middle Ages was known as Lancashire County Palatine and ruled by a duke. Today, the area comprises of Lancashire and parts of Merseyside, Greater Manchester, Cheshire and Cumbria. A leaked internal duchy policy from 2020 gave officials at the King's estate license to use bona vacantia funds on a broad array of its profit-generating portfolio. Codenamed SA9, the policy acknowledges spending the money in this way could result in an incidental benefit to the privy purse, the King's personal income. Properties identified in other leaked documents as eligible for use of the funds include townhouses, holiday lets, rural cottages, agricultural buildings, a former petrol station, and barns, including one used to facilitate pheasant and partridge shoots in Yorkshire. Upgrades include new roofs, double glazing windows, boiler installations and replacements of doors and lintels. One document refers to renovation of an old farmhouse in Yorkshire, helping transform it into a high-end residential let. Another upgrade is helping turn a firm building into a commercial offices. Three sources familiar with the Duchy of Lancaster's expenditure confirmed the estate was using revenues collected from the dead citizens to refurbish its profitable property portfolio, making considerable savings for the estate. One said, Duchy of Lancaster insiders regarded the Bona Vacantia expenditure, which has until now not been publicly disclosed, as akin to free money and a slush fund. The diversion of Bona Vacantia funds in this way has proven a financial boon to the King's estate. The practice is helping make rental properties more profitable, which indirectly benefits King Charles, who receives tens of millions of pounds in duchy profits each year, income that Buckingham Palace says is private. Earlier this year, in his first annual payout since inheriting the estate from his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, King Charles received £26 million from the Duchy of Lancaster. The Guardian identified dozens of people whose money has been transferred to the King's hereditary estate after they died in northwest of England in places like Preston, Manchester, Burnley, Blackburn, Liverpool, Ulverston and Oldham. Several had been living in rundown properties or social housing estates that contrast with the high-end Duchy of Lancaster properties being transformed with the money that they left behind. Some of their surviving friends were aghast to learn that their assets were being used to renovate King Charles's properties, calling the practice disgusting, shocking and not ethical. Buckingham Palace, meanwhile, has declined to comment. A Duchy of Lancaster spokesperson indicated that following his mother's death, King Charles endorsed the continuation of a policy of using Bona Vacantia money under restoration and repair of qualifying buildings in order to protect and preserve them for future generations. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. In most of England and Wales, the assets of people who die without making a will and have no identifiable relatives are transferred to the Treasury, which then spends them on public services. The system is known by the Latin name bona vacantia, meaning vacant goods or assets that have no owner. However, under a custom that has its roots in the medieval times, two hereditary estates or duchies belonging to the royal family can collect bona vacantia from people who die in two regions in England. They also collect leftover assets owned by companies at the point they are dissolved. One is the Duchy of Cornwall, which generates profits for whoever is the heir to the throne. King Charles used to closely manage the Duchy of Cornwall, but last year it passed on to his son, Prince William. It collects bona vacantia funds from deceased Cornish residents. The other is the Duchy of Lancaster, inherited by King Charles III from his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, when she died last year. Both duchies are professionally run real estate empires that manage swathes of farmland, hotels, castles, offices, warehouses, shops and urban property, including some of London's prime luxury real estate. Neither duchy pays corporation tax or capital gains tax, giving them a significant commercial advantage. They have become huge cash cows for the royals, generating the equivalent of more than £1.2 billion in profits over the last 60 years. Both duchies have long claimed that once costs are deducted, the money is distributed to charities. The Duchy of Lancaster's website states that proceeds of bona vacantia go to three registered charities after costs are deducted. However, its account suggests only 15% of the £61 million it has collected in bona vacantia payments over the last decade has been donated to charities. According to multiple sources familiar with the Duchy of Lancaster expenditures, a large and growing proportion of bona vacantia funds have for several years been directed towards renovating properties that the duchy lets out on a commercial basis. The sources said the practice accelerated from May of 2020, when policy SA9 was introduced to provide duchy staff with guidance on what bona vacantia could be spent on. The term bona vacantia was not used in the policy. Instead, it contains a vague reference to special costs. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam by Ayatollah Khamenei. Palestine belongs to Palestinians. June 4th, 2011. Palestine cannot be partitioned. Palestine belongs to the Palestinians entirely. The Islamic Republic presented the solution to the Palestinian issue several years ago. The solution to the issue of Palestine is not the kind of solutions that America and other such countries present. Such solutions will prove ineffective. The solution is to hold a referendum among the people of Palestine. Any government that receives the majority of the votes in the referendum will rule the entire Palestinian lands. Then that government will decide what to do with the Zionists who immigrated to Palestine. And this depends on the decision of the government that will be elected by the people of Palestine.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today,
and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Defending Palestine is a must for all Muslims. March 4th, 2010. The enemies of the world of Islam have always tried to make maximum use of denominational, tribal, geographical, and regional differences. And today, they are using modern instruments to fulfill their purpose. We should pay attention to this, and we should awaken. They want to busy us with one another so that they can distract our attention from the main point. They want to pit Muslim ethnicities, nations, and denominations, including Shia, Sunni, and other Islamic denominations, against one another so that the issue of Israel will be forgotten. The issue of occupying Palestine should have made us get close to one another, but they are using it to make us drift away from one another. They create discord in the world of Islam and pit governments against one another by using the issue of Palestine. The issue of Palestine is a clear issue. There is no Islamic denomination that has any doubts about the fact that jihad is wajib for Muslims whenever an Islamic land is under attack. All Islamic denominations share this belief, and there's no ground for disagreement on this matter. However, the enemies cast doubt on this matter which all Muslims believe in. They create division among Muslims. They provoke denominational and tribal prejudice, and they fuel its fire so that they can freely pursue their goals.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Saturdays. In
the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek